We're continuing our study of the general subject of suffering and patience. If you were here last week, you'll recall we looked at an example of how not to do it, story of Israel in the wilderness. We noticed in last week's lesson all of the sufferings that came to the Israelites as they were on their trek through the wilderness. The problem was they handled it very poorly. God had his reasons, as we noticed, for sending the Israelites to the wilderness and subjecting them to the hardships that they went through. It was for their good if they would have cooperated with it. But instead of cooperating, they complained and murmured and griped and just rebelled against God. And as a result, that generation that came out of Egypt was doomed to wander for 40 years until they died off. And it was their children and grandchildren who actually benefited from their time in the wilderness. They were tougher, they were stronger, and they were ready to enter the land when the time came. Tonight we're going to start with the first of a series of individuals in the Bible who suffered, yet handled it appropriately, and in the end became better people for it. And our study this evening is going to deal with the historical character of Job. Get your Bible and turn to the book of Job. We're going to spend all of our time out of this book. We'll be going back and forth through the book, looking at a number of different passages. In the New Testament epistle of James, chapter 5, James refers to Job as an example of patience in a section that we've looked at in a previous lesson, in which he's exhorting his readers to be patient in the face of the hardships that they are experiencing. James points back to the book of Job and says, here's the kind of person we ought to be. So that gives a stamp of approval to what we're reading here in the book of Job. In the first chart that we're going to look at this evening, we're just going to provide a quick overview of the book. One of the fascinating things about the book of Job is that there's absolutely no reference anywhere in the book to the law of Moses, the nation of Israel, the temple, any of the things that we would normally associate with Israelite culture or history or worship or religion. None of that is there. And for that reason, most commentators believe that Job probably would have to be dated earlier than the Israelite nation, perhaps even contemporaneous with somebody like Abraham, one of the patriarchs. And if that's the case, even though the book itself was probably written during the reign of Solomon, it is describing a period of time, an event, a person, that goes back to the time of Genesis. It could almost be, perhaps, one of the earliest stories in the Bible. Wouldn't it be interesting that the first book that was written in the Bible deals with the subject of suffering? Because what that means is that this is universal. I mean, this is the common concern of all mankind. Why do we suffer? How do we deal with suffering? And the book of Job confronts that problem head on. Very quickly, in this chart where we have an overview of the book, the first two chapters set up the story. All these sufferings that came upon Job, we'll talk about that in a moment. But really the important thing in chapter 1 and verse 9 is a conversation between Satan and God. Now, this is a conversation that Job is not privy to. He has no idea of what the setup is for his circumstances. Satan's complaint to God is, will a man fear God for nothing? Does Job fear God for nothing? He is accusing God of basically bribing Job to serve him. You've given Job everything a man could want. He has a happy family. He has a lot of prosperity, wealth. He has good health. I mean, everything that a man could want, you've given it to him. Of course he's going to serve you. Take all that stuff away, and he will curse you to your face. That's Satan's charge against God. And God said, okay, let's see. Let's find out. And so God gives Satan the prerogative of inflicting harm, suffering, upon Job. And so really the question that hangs over the entire book of Job is this question of Satan. Does Job fear God for nothing? If you took everything away from Job, everything that made this life happy and prosperous and joyful, if you took all of that away from him, would he still serve God? God and Satan are looking at Job throughout the book to find out which side of that question he's going to fall. Job is the one that's going to have to make the ultimate decision as to how he responds to the terrible things that happened to him. Chapters 3 through 37 is a dialogue between Job and his friends, where they go back and forth, debating, arguing, kicking around ideas about why Job is suffering. And if I could ask anybody, what is the dominant theory of Job's friends as to why he's suffering? Job has sinned. He's done something to deserve it. This is the, in Hindu theology, this would be the karma approach to suffering. We get what we deserve. And they have a very simplistic approach to Job's predicament. Bad people get bad things in life. Good people get good things. And for Job, to this point, who's been apparently a good man, has prospered well, for his whole world to collapse as it has, obviously there's something in Job's life that he has done that has brought this calamity upon him. Job has earned whatever's come his way. Now, they have no details as to what his sin might be, but they're confident that Job has done something to deserve the terrible fate that has befallen him. In chapters 38 through 41, God speaks. And the really interesting thing here in God's address to Job and his friends is that he never does answer the question as to why Job is suffering. In fact, you reach the end of the book, Job never does get a really clear, crisp answer as to why all the suffering has come upon him. What God does emphasize, though, is his power, his majesty, his might, his grandeur. Everything about him suggests he's in charge here. The implication being, I have my reasons. It is not really necessary for Job to know all the details and the ins and the outs and the permutations of why God runs his universe the way he does. All Job needs to know is God is in control and God's going to make everything work out right. And so that's how God enters the picture. And then chapter 42 is the epilogue or the conclusion, the wrapping up. And the thing that I find fascinating in this closing chapter is God's statement concerning Job in verse 7, that Job spoke what was right. Job spoke what was right. Kind of lock that into your mind as we get into our study this evening, because that's very critical. It really feeds back to what James said in James chapter 5, that Job is the perfect example of somebody who has patience in suffering. The things that he spoke were right. But as we get into the book of Job and look at some of the details, we're going to struggle with this a little bit. And you'll see what we're talking about in just a moment. Very quickly, Job's sufferings in chapters 1 and 2, his oxen and donkeys were taken by the Sabaeans. His flock of sheep were destroyed by fire from heaven. We have no idea what that was. Camels were taken by the Chaldeans. And by the way, oxen, donkey, sheep, camels, why is it a big deal for Job to lose all of these things? That was his wealth, wasn't it? This is an agricultural society, and so that was the bulk of his prosperity. And for all of this to be taken away from him by various means at basically one time was effectively to destroy him financially. Then, on top of that, his sons and daughters were killed by a whirlwind that came through and collapsed the house in which they were gathered. His health in chapter 2 was destroyed by boils. He had terrible boils from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet. Have any of you ever had a boil in your life? I had one, and I distinctly remember it in second grade. It was the most painful thing I ever experienced. And every time I reflect on the book of Job, I think back to that boil that I had. And I just cannot fathom having your whole body covered with that sort of thing. It had to be just an awful experience for Job. I add these two second bullets here. They're usually not mentioned in the context of Job's sufferings, but I think they contribute to it. The fact that his wife abandoned him emotionally, what advice did she have for Job? Curse God and die. Curse God and die. Well, thanks for the encouragement, honey. What good is she going to be to him now? How did it impact Job? I've often noted maybe the reason that Satan spared her. She would do more to advance Satan's agenda alive than dead. Let her stay around. Let her be an additional thorn in Job's side. And then finally, the accusations of his friends that he must have done something horrible to deserve all of this. Now, if you've ever been falsely accused by somebody, you know how that stings, right? That is not a pleasant thing. And here, Job is being accused by his friend. And not just a one-time thing. They hound him about this throughout the book. They start out in the opening chapters being a little diplomatic, tactful about it, hinting around that, Job, you might want to, you know, look at your life a little. And by the end of the book, they're just beating up on the guy. You are a hypocrite, Job. You've done something. You need to confess your sin before God. I mean, they just pound the poor guy. So Job has to deal with that now on top of everything else. There's just all these terrible things that have happened to Job. By the way, and I'll tie this back to an earlier lesson where we were looking at suffering and the various forms that suffering comes in our life. There's one form of suffering that you do not find on this list. What is it? We see suffering that's been inflicted by other men, right? We see suffering that has been inflicted by nature, or what we would call acts of God. But there's one form of suffering that you don't see on this list. A form of suffering that is very common today in the lives of a lot of people. Right, how much of our suffering today is due to our own dumb choices, right? We say and do stupid things, and, well, yeah, we bring it on ourselves. Of course, that's what Job's friends are accusing him of, but as far as the record is concerned, that's not Job. There's nothing in this litany of disasters that befell him that can be attributed to his bad decisions. So that's off the table. Okay, so with this, in the first two chapters, this sets up the story of Job and all the sufferings that came upon him. Most people can relate as they look at all these terrible things that happened to Job. Most people can relate to at least some of this. Now we're going to see how Job's dealing with it. There are a few verses here I'd like for us to look at relating to Job's emotional state, how he's reacting now to the suffering that has befallen him. Initially, and this is in chapter 2 and verse 10, this is the answer that Job gives to his wife when she tells him to curse God and die. His response, chapter 2, verse 10, is, "Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?" The verse goes on to say, "In all this, Job did not sin with his lips." How would you describe his original reaction to all this that has come upon him, just based on that verse? He basically says, "I will accept the bad that comes from God as well as the good," right? How does that compare to the Israelites that we studied last week? Well, there's just no comparison, right? So you look at that and you say, wow, this guy really has his act together. We would almost use the word stoic to describe his response at this point. But as you get deeper into the dialogue between Job and his friends, his tone changes. A couple of examples, chapter 7 and verse 11. He says, "I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul." And he uses the same language later in chapter 10 and verse 1. "My soul loathes my life. I will give free course to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul." Now, what happened to the stoicism? It sounds like Job's beginning to lose it here, right? I'm bitter, I'm complaining, and I'm not going to shut up about this. I'm going to give voice to what I feel in my heart now. And he does. He says some pretty strong things. Now, in the next chart, we're going to spend a little time on this. We're going to have to skim through it fairly quickly. But I want us to notice, as we go through here, some of the things that we would have to say were harsh that Job spoke through the course of these chapters. Number one, he held God responsible for what had happened to him. Look in chapter 7 and verse 20. Job asks, "Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target so that I am a burden to myself?" He sees himself as God's target. God's taking target practice on him. Chapter 13, verse 24. "Why do you hide your face and regard me as your enemy?" Chapter 16 and verse 9, speaking of God, "He tears me in his wrath and hates me. He gnashes at me with his teeth." Really? Job thinks that God hates him? That's what he says. That's pretty strong, isn't it? Look in chapter 30 and verse 21. "But you have become cruel to me with the strength of your hand. You oppose me." Go back to chapter 12 and verse 9. Who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? Who's he attributing all of his downfall to? God. The hand of the Lord has done this. Chapter 19 and verse 6. Know then that God has wronged me and has surrounded me with his net. God's done this to him. Job holds God responsible for it. And it's not just that God did it, but God was doing so unjustly. Again in chapter 9, look in verse 17 and 18. Several verses here in chapter 9 we want to look at. For he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not allow me to catch my breath, but fills me with bitterness. And then verses 22 and 23, same chapter. It is all one thing. Therefore I say, he destroys the blameless and the wicked. If the scourge slays suddenly, he laughs at the plight of the innocent. Chapter 27 and verse 2. As God lives, who has taken away my justice, and the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter. God takes away justice. Now, if God is a just God, why has all this happened to me, someone who doesn't deserve it? Does that sound familiar? Do we hear that complaint today a lot? I don't deserve this. Why is this happening to me? There really was a good, just, holy God. Why would he allow this to happen to me? God is not just. So that's the kind of complaint that Job is laying out here. And we won't take the time to look at chapters 29 and 31, but if you would read those two chapters, especially 31, Job is basically doing a personal inventory. He's going through his life. He's kind of replaying the kind of life that he has lived up to this point. And the claim that he's making throughout these chapters is, I have tried to be a good man. I've not only tried to do the right thing, I've even tried to harness my mind, keep my attitude, my thoughts under control. How many of us can make that boast? Job said, that's the kind of man I've tried to be. Now, I don't think Job is claiming perfection here. He's just racking his brain trying to figure out, God, what is my crime to have deserved all of this that you have done to me? And so he's just recounting the life that he has lived up to this point. He's tried to do everything right. He's been good, generous, kind to other people, respectful of God and his law. And this is what he gets for it in response? In Job's mind, it just doesn't make any sense. And so he's angry. Look in chapter 23. Verses 3 and 4. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. Now, I want you to try to visualize what Job is describing here. If I could come into the presence of God, what would I do? I would plead my case. Would he do so meekly and on bended knees? Is that the description he gives here? I would fill my mouth with arguments. I give God a piece of my mind because this is not right. This should not have happened to me. And why God let it happen, I don't know, but I'd give him a piece of my mind if I had the opportunity to do so. Chapter 10 and verse 2. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Show me why you contend with me. Is that our prerogative to make demands on God? Doesn't that sound like what Job is doing here? I would contend with God and demand an explanation as to why he's allowed all this to happen to me. But at the same time, he's still terrified of God. Look in chapter 7 and verse 14. You scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions. Chapter 23 and verse 15. Therefore I am terrified at his presence. When I consider this, I am afraid of him. For God made my heart weak and the Almighty terrifies me. Then finally, chapter 9, and verse 29. I think this is a key verse in the book. Job says, if I am condemned, why then do I labor in vain? Now, ponder what Job is saying there. If I am condemned, that is, if I've done something to deserve all of this, I don't even know what it was, but if I've done something to deserve all this, and God has rendered his judgment, I stand condemned before God, then he poses the question, why do I labor in vain? Why do I even try? You ever felt that way in your life? This is the way life's going to treat me. What do I owe life? Why should I even bother? That sounds like a man that's about to give up, right? He's about to throw in the towel. Because if he starts asking himself, why should I even bother anymore? This is pretty serious. Now then, remember though, what have we already been told about Job and his reaction to suffering? He spoke right about God and that he dealt with suffering with patience. Does this sound like a patient man? Let's proceed further. Job, as we've already noted, was in fact patient. That's the way the Bible described him. And there's three things I'd like for us to notice about Job. Number one, he still talked to God. Now, if somebody suffers horribly and they conclude, well, a good and just God would not allow this to happen to me, therefore I don't believe in God, and just goes off in a hole to die. Is that Job? What's he doing through all of these chapters? He's angry at God. He's mad at God. He doesn't understand God. But who's he talking to? Well, his friends and God. Half of his talking is directed at God. Do you ever have a close friend, a spouse maybe, that you get upset with? How do you deal with the being upset? Hopefully, if you have a healthy relationship. You talk it out, right? And that's what I think we need to keep in mind here. Yeah, Job's upset. He's angry about what's happened to him. He does not understand why God has treated him this way, but it's precisely because he loves God and has had such a close relationship with God that he talks as frankly to God as he does. Let that sink in into your understanding of this whole equation, how Job is reacting to the suffering that's come into his life. And there are three verses that stand out in what Job said that really define his relationship with God. Look in chapter 27, verses 5 and 6. Far be it from me that I should say you are right. And he's the you here is his friends who are accusing him of sin. Far from me that I should say you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. Now, what is Job driving his stake in the ground with here? What declaration is he making? The passage that we noted a moment ago where Job says, why do I even try? Why do I labor in vain? Sounded like he's stepping over the line into, I'm not even going to try anymore. What's he saying here? I'm not going to step over that line. I'm going to hold fast to my convictions, to my integrity, to the life that I know God wants me to live, even though I don't understand why things are going the way they are. Look in chapter 19 and verse 25. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at last on the earth. And after my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself. And my eyes shall behold, and not another, how my heart yearns within me. What is his hope that he's expressing here? Despite the calamity he's experiencing, what does he hope? He's going to see God someday. Now, how it all plays out, he's not quite sure, but he knows it's going to happen. And he looks forward to that time when he can stand in the presence of God. Chapter 13, verse 15. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Even so, I will defend my own ways before him. Though he slay me, yet will I serve him. Wow, you talk about faith. You know, you can compare this to the story of Abraham. What did God want Abraham to do? Sacrifice his son. Abraham, if he had a choice, he would probably rather sacrifice himself than his son. And this is what Job is saying here. If he chooses to slay me, for whatever reason he has, I'm still going to serve him. I will not give up my relationship to God. And then chapter 23 and verse 10. But he knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. In this, we see Job's suspicion that there's something else in play here. There's something else going on. He can't quite put his finger on it, but he's confident that if he can just hold on through this, whatever the reasons for it, that when he comes out on the other side, he's going to be a better man for it. He's going through a refining process. Just as the ore is refined and pure gold comes out on the other side, Job anticipates, that's what's going to happen to me. I'm going to be a better man because of what I'm experiencing here. So then, we've seen both the harsh things that Job has said, and we've seen these powerful demonstrations of a faith that he refuses to give up. So you put both of those side by side, and that really, I think, defines the patience of Job. Last week, we posed the question in talking about Israel in the wilderness, how much they complained about what was happening to them, and we've seen this evening how much Job complained about what was happening to him. Why aren't these people in the same category then? They're both complaining. Here's the difference. Both of them complained bitterly about their suffering. Neither of them had any idea why God was allowing them to suffer, but the difference is Israel lost their confidence in God. In fact, as we noted last week, they reached a point where they just didn't believe Him anymore. Nothing God said had any impact on them. They just turned their back on Him. Job didn't do that. Job, for whatever reason, he held fast to God in faith. That's why I see in the book of Job just a fantastic example of a mature way to deal with suffering. We need to remove from our consideration the idea that if I truly had my act all together and something terrible happened to me in my life, that I could just, you know, peacefully, nonchalantly go through it and deal with it, and it would just roll off my back, and you know, everybody would say, oh, wow, you're so strong, you're so powerful. No, that's not realistic. That's not humanity. Job is humanity. The second point here, suffering hurts, and God understands our pain. He understands our frustration. And He doesn't mind if we scream and yell at Him, as long as we do it in faith, if you can figure that out. God, I don't understand why you're doing this to me. This isn't fair. It's not right. I'm going to keep on serving you. That's off the table. That's not in question. But God, why are you doing this to me? That's the kind of thing that we see in the book of Job. And yet the Bible writers call this patience. You hold fast to what you believe and refuse to give it up. We have a choice how to respond to the suffering that comes our way. Israel's statement was, is God among us or not? With the implication being, He's not. So, fooey on him. Job's response, though, was, though He slay me, yet will I trust Him. I will not give up, no matter what happens in my life. Next week, we're going to be looking at the story of Joseph in the book of Genesis, another example of patience in suffering.